Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Arizona Board of Osteopathic Examiners in Medicine and Surgery. Board meeting on Friday, June 30th at 2023. And time is approximately 8:34 a.m. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Mr. Boho, can we have a roll call and review of agenda?
Yes. Dr. Oda.
I'm here.
Dr. Walker.
Present.
Mr. Berg is absent. Mr. Goodman.
Present.
Dr. Chiffon?
Present.
Dr. Matem?
Present.
Dr. Erbstesser?
Present.
You have a quorum, sir.
Thank you. Bohol. The mission of the board is to protect the public by setting educational training standards for the licensure and by reviewing complaints made against osteopathic physicians, interns, and residents to ensure that their conduct meets the standards of the profession as defined by law ARS 32-1854. We're going to move on to the call to the public. Item B, if any member of the public who is not a respondent or licensee or applicant or a complainant wishes to address the board on a matter that appears on the agenda, you would be asked to speak during the call to the public. If you wish to address the board on an issue not on the agenda, you will be asked to speak during the call to the public, and all those wishing to speak should contact the member of the board staff at this time. Mr. Bohol?
Yes, I believe we do have someone calling in to speak. If you would like to push star 6 to unmute yourself, you can speak to the board. You will have 2 minutes to do so. Again, if you would like to push star 6 to unmute. Okay. I guess they don't want to speak. I will keep an eye on it. If I receive any messages or anything, I will let you know.
Moving on to item 4, review and consideration approval of minutes. 4A, May 20th, 2023, open session. We've all had a chance to review it. Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Do I have a second?
I'm second.
Dr. Chiffon, thank you. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Moving on to 4B, May 20, 2023, executive session. Do I have a motion to approve?
Motion to approve, sir.
Motion approved. Do I have a second?
Second.
Dr. Chiffon, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. Moving on to item 5A, review, discussion, and possible action on matters set for formal hearing. Case 5A, DO-23-00158, Dr. Griffin Cipolla, license number 007732. Is the doctor here or any representative?
Chair Erbstesser, members of the board, Flynn Carey is here representing Dr. Cipolla.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Thank you for identifying yourself. Okay. As we move forward here, I think the best way that we want to do this as a board is to move into executive session. And I'm going to make a motion to move into executive session. Do I have a second?
I have a second to move into executive session for legal advice.
Dr. Maida, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? None. Okay. We'll be right back.
Sorry, before we move, do we need any personal and confidential discussion on that motion, Ms. Galvin, or just legal advice on this?
I would ask that Ms. Didia provide that information to you. She's providing independent legal advice to the board as this matter has been moved to formal hearing.
So we do that in executive session?
Well, I will just amend my a second to and possible personal and confidential information.
Good. Thank you, Dr. Madam. All in favor say aye.
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 Ms. Dita, are you coming? You're coming into the executive session. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. What about Mr. Carey?
No.
No. Okay. All right.
Neither party.
Okay. All right. Bear with us, Mr. Carey. We'll be back.
Of course. Thank you.
You should be receiving the invite now.
All right. Welcome back, folks. We're coming back from executive session. I would like to make a motion. I motion that the board delegate authority to settle the case to the board's executive director with terms as discussed in executive session. Do I have a second?
I second that, Mr. President.
Wait a second. We need a roll call vote.
It looks like Mr. Dedea would...
Yes, sorry, I was on mute, sorry. Yes, roll call.
I'll do a roll call vote. Dr. Oda.
Yes.
Dr. Walker.
Yes.
Mr. Goodman.
Aye.
Dr. Chabon.
Yes.
Dr. Matem.
Aye.
Dr. Erbstoser.
Yes. Okay, motion passes. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Carey.
Yes, thank you, Chair Erbstoser, members of the board.
All right, let's move on to item 6, which is review and discussion and action on investigative hearings pursuant ARS 32-1855, case 6A, DO-22-0151A, Dr. Linda Sedoma. Is the doctor here?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Is the complainant here?
The complainant does not appear to be signed in to speak.
Okay. And can you just quickly introduce your counsel, and then we'll move forward and swear you in.
This is Mr. Steve Bullington. He's representing me.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bullington. Okay, Ms. Castro, can you please swear in the doctor?
Dr. Sedoma, will you please raise your right hand? Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Doctor, can you just give us a brief summary of your training and currently what you're doing, and then we will then we'll have a case review.
Well, I'm a gynecologist in private practice. I've been in practice since 1999, and I do office GYN as well as surgical GYN as well.
Great. Thank you. All right, Dr. Prah, can you please give us a summary?
Yes. this case was sent for review by an expert in the field, a board-certified OBGYN physician. The complainant alleges that Dr. Sedoma started her on testosterone without first obtaining laboratory and never explaining how to give herself injections. She states she was seen by a new OBGYN and was told the dose Dr. Sedoma had started her on was extremely high and used for patients that wanted to transition from female to male. She states her testosterone levels were 4 times higher than normal, and she had already begun to have changes in her voice, facial hair, genital enlargement, and breast size reduction. This was a 36-year-old female that was seen in Dr. Sedoma's office for lack of libido, sexual dysfunction, anxiety, brain fog, depression, fatigue, forgetfulness, night sweats, hot flashes, insomnia, and weight gain. She stated she had not had any menses for the last 6 months. Dr. Sedoma started the patient on testosterone injections, a half a cc IM, every week for 30 days, and she was given a year's supply. Dr. Barrick, the OBGYN expert, felt that Dr. Sedoma fell below the standard of care in that the history documented was inaccurate because of inconsistent statements within the record. He felt the physical exam was incomplete because there was no pelvic examination in a patient whose problems were mostly gynecologic. He states there was also no discussion about the use of testosterone for premenopausal libido symptoms, the risks and possible complications or alternatives. He states the physician stated she did not suggest the patient self-administer the testosterone, this is she said in her board response, yet the patient, she gave the patient syringes and testosterone with refills for 1 year. He notes no actual dose of testosterone was documented in the medical record. He notes the laboratory findings indicate no hormonal abnormalities were found. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Prowl. I'm going to have the doctor next, but I'm going to ask counsel if he would like to speak or would he like to wait a little bit later. What would you prefer, Mr. Bullington?
I would like to wait. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Well, Dr. Sodoma, can you give us a little response to the summary? And you, I'm sure you can answer some of these questions we have concern about.
Of course. I would like to state that when I met this patient, she seemed desperate to me and focused on receiving testosterone replacement therapy. I wanted to let the board know that I completed additional training in 2016 through Hormone Treatment Centers of America for bioidentical hormone replacement therapy in the form of pellet therapy. I perform hormone therapy consultations as per patient request. The first visit does not include a physical exam unless the patient presents for a well woman exam, which would be a separate visit. A second exam or third exam would be required to review labs and discuss therapy, usually a month later, because the patient needs to have her blood work testing. She needs an appointment with the lab to do so. The testosterone level takes the longest to get back, which can take 7 to 10 days. There are rarely emergency hormone treatments, so I typically treat these patients in a slow manner, not in a rush. When I met this patient, she informed me in the first minute of our visit that she had already been discharged by another physician, and she was very concerned about starting therapy immediately. She was concerned about her lack of libido and her mood swings, and she appeared very desperate to me. I was typing while she was talking, and I noticed that there were inconsistencies in the record keeping, but I closed the chart prior to adjusting when I was talking to her, so there were a lot of inconsistencies in the record keeping, to which I apologize, of course. It's something that I'm always trying to work on. But I like to spend face-to-face time with the patient, and I did spend a lot of time with this patient counseling her over risks, benefits, and options. I did, in our visit, although it is not documented, I discussed her options and the potential side effects. I was clear that to the patient that this is a collaborative process, as we may or may not know, testosterone replacement therapy in a non-menopausal woman is very controversial, and it's very case-specific. What works for some might not work for others. I wanted her to come back to review the blood work and go over the treatments as we get more information. I felt she was an appropriate candidate for testosterone replacement. If testosterone is to be replaced, I recommend pellet therapy because of the slow release. I told her that I do not really have familiarity with injected testosterone because of the up and down nature, the peak and trough nature of that hormone that can exacerbate moods. And I was concerned, but patient did seem desperate. I did something I never do, which is write the prescription. But my intention was for her to bring it back to the office so we can go over these things. My intention was not for her to just initiate and continue the injections without further counseling. So she writes me an email and that she wanted to have her dosage increased. And I did not feel comfortable with this at all. So I asked her to come back for further counseling. She did not. And she was just, I was concerned that it was exacerbating her psychiatric symptoms, which she claimed that she had a psychiatric background. And again, that's not reflected in my note. Let's see. The patient asked for the syringes because she wanted to start injecting herself. So again, I never do this, and I haven't done it since. And my understanding was that she was going to come back for further counseling. As far as the 12 refills go, testosterone is a controlled substance, so the pharmacy is not going to honor 12 refills of a testosterone injection. So they usually go by a monthly, and then you have to rewrite a prescription every month. Some pharmacies will do it for 3 months, but that's not the standard. So I did write for 12 injections, but of course that's not honored. And she wanted to just communicate by email. I did not feel that that was appropriate. I answered her right away in her emails because they were very volatile in nature. And from my concern, I relayed that I wanted her to stop these injections right away. But she never gave me a chance. She never came back. I was never able to order any more blood work or even counsel the patient. I felt that we were at an impasse because whatever I recommended, she refused and just kept doing whatever she wanted to do, and I can't work that way. So I did something I never do as well. I discharged her from my practice because we were at an impasse. And I've been in practice for 23 years. I've seen over 25,000 patients, and I've been doing hormone replacement therapy since 2016. I can count how many patients I've discharged in my whole career is about 8, and I did OB. And, so this is something very, very rare. But I felt that there I have really no choice. Thank you.
Questions from the board. I have a couple here. I'll start. So what was the dose of testosterone she was giving? All I see in the records was a half a CCIM. And was that on a daily basis, or was that every 2 weeks, 1 week? How was that written?
Well, I wrote an arbitrary dose of half a CC, which was 200 milligrams of testosterone cyprionate per mil. So it's half a CC every week. But again, that was not my intention for her to take that dose or even do that on that frequent a basis. This was just to get her tied over because she exhibited that she had an urgency to receive this medication because she felt that it would help all of her symptoms.
Yeah, so she was getting 100 milligrams once a week.
Yes. But theoretically, I don't know if that's what she was taking, though, because she was not supervised.
I think she could be giving herself a lot more, for sure.
She could have, because she went through that vial very quickly within the month. If it's a 5 cc vial, that should last you for 10 weeks. But she was requesting refills. Of course, the pharmacy doesn't honor it because it's a controlled substance. But she was requesting refills right away. So I think she was taking more than that.
Did that worry you? I mean, I would think that, you know, these people are self-medicating without the doctor's advice.
Of course it worried me. And I felt really stupid that this happened in the first place because I did what the patient asked me to do, and I regret it. And I've never done it since. I've never done it before. I've never done it since. I just felt compelled to help her.
She kind of opened a bucket, that's for sure. And then my other question that I have, so I'm looking at when she was here as a new patient, and this was...
I saw her once.
Yeah. New patient on 8/31 of 2022. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
Okay. And then as I'm going through here, I'm looking at the history, tubal ligation, you know, I did an STD summary, but it says her menstrual cycle, says the LMP date was 7/31 of 2022. Mm-hmm. Normal menses was checked, yes. Monthly menses was checked, yes. Duration of the menstrual cycle was 28 days. Severity of the menstruation is normal. Menstrual pain, yes. So I'm a little confused about that.
Yes, but that's what the patient relayed to me. So
she was having normal periods.
Yes, she had no abnormalities that she stated. I didn't do an exam on her because she was there for a specific hormone consult, specifically for testosterone therapy, and specifically for testosterone injections.
So she wasn't menopausal?
She was not menopausal. She had menopausal symptoms, but she was not menopausal.
Well, yeah, that's that was a little concern for me when we're prescribing this medication for a 36-year-old female who obviously has some other issues that are contributing to her feelings and how she feels. All right, I'm going to just open to the board here, see if any members have any other questions or concerns.
I can ask questions next, if that's okay, Dr. Erbstrasser.
Oh, my pleasure. Go ahead, Dr. Maynham.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry, Dr. Sidoma, the first question is one out of total ignorance, and I know I've seen this before, but your board is the American Congress of Obstetrician and Gynecologists, is that correct?
Correct.
And is that that's not an AOA, is that an AMA recognized board?
Yes.
But the framework is the same, obviously. Hormonal replacement therapy, et cetera, is something that's covered during your training?
Correct.
I appreciate it. Sorry, that's just totally out of ignorance. I have to ask these questions. I like to have an idea what I'm talking about. my next question is to the board first, then you, Dr. Sidoma. We do have some primary care physicians on the board who would be more familiar with this. I apologize, Dr. Sidoma. I'm an emergency medicine physician, and I've prescribed testosterone zero times in my life, and over the last 25 years, and probably will prescribe it the same in the next 25 years.
Yeah.
So to my primary care cohorts with prescription, such as a hormonal replacement, such as testosterone, is that something that you would typically perform a gynecologic exam? Our consultant said that was part of the standard of care, but what is your what are your opinions on that?
No, I do a physical exam.
I'm sorry, just board first, Dr. Sidoma. I apologize.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. I talked for a little bit there. I lost you, but don't worry. Just give me just a moment, and I'll get right back to you.
Sure.
So I can answer that question, Dr. Maynham. Boarded family practice. So I don't do female hormone replacement at a high volume. Certainly patients that have a gynecologist that they see regularly, I would at the very least obtain records from their GYN who had recently done, you know, the well woman exam to ensure that a history and physical was done on them before implementing any kind of hormone replacement. But typically I do refer them to either a hormone specialist or to their back to their gynecologist to do that type of therapy. I guess in this scenario, I would certainly be thinking more about causes other than hormonal derangements for this patient's symptoms.
Thank you. That helps, Dr. Oda. Anybody else from the board?
Well, go ahead, Dr. Walker. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Dr. Maynham, I'm also a family practice board certified. We do hormone replacement in my clinic, not so much testosterone for females, but for men. But certainly when we have this conversation, just like Dr. Oda said, you know, you get a good history and physical, and the blood work would look for other etiology for hormone dysfunction. But as far as women, typically I would refer them out to a specialist who works with bioidenticals and make sure their gynecological exam is up to date, either by myself or the GYN. But I would not require a GYN exam on prior to me prescribing the medication.
Thank you. And you were going to say something too, Dr. Erbstrasser?
Well, I was just going to tell you, you know, I'm going to let you finish, Dr. Maynham, and then I'll just...
Okay. Dr. Pra, if you're not being swarmed by a plague of bees at this time, if I remember correctly... She does have a bee problem in her home behind her right now, by the way.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, once or twice, we've already in the last few years seen a case with specialists. It was with male testosterone replacement where the outside medical consultant reported that there was a falling below standard of care for not doing a general urinary exam. Do I remember correctly? Again, those were males, not females. But to remember that correctly, it was with testosterone.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, Dr. Sidoma, I really was not trying to be rude to cut you off before. The outside medical consultant was concerned that it was below the standard of care. What is the difference from the medical consultant, our prior male testosterone patients and GU examination in this case? I understand the time frame is probably not have to be real time, but what is the difference, or why do you not do a GYN exam?
Well, she didn't have any specific complaints gynecologically. She was up to date on her visits. We have so much information to go over. When I have a patient coming in for a hormone consult, it's very distracting, and I think the error in my ways is really giving her the prescription ahead of time, but it wasn't my intention for her to start it. She didn't really have any complaints. Like, she said that she had a low libido, but she could climax, so physiologically that means that she's working correctly. And she claimed to me to have her period still, and I didn't feel that it was really indicated. She's had a child before, so most likely she was physiologically intact. So I don't do a physical exam on our first visit. This is supposed to be a relationship where I see them several times. It was I just counseled her.
No, I do appreciate that. I understand there can be some ebb and flow with that. And if I remember correctly, during the initial evaluation, you did not get lab work, and the patient had declined or expressed disinterest in doing the lab work after that. Do you remember the chart correctly?
I gave her the lab work to do so I could have a baseline testosterone.
Sure.
And then once she gets that baseline testosterone, then she can come back and we can go over what the lab work was. That was the intention.
Thank you. I know I do understand pressures from patients. I get them on a regular basis, too. I'm sure others do, too.
Yeah.
I'd like to turn that back to the board for just a little bit and then come back and after somebody else speaks, if that's okay, Dr. Erbstrasser.
Yes, sir, Dr. Matem. What was the level that was super high, Barb? I couldn't really find that. You said it was four times or?
That's what the complainant stated, that the second opinion OB-GYN told her testosterone level was four times what it should have been, or the dose was four times higher than it should have been. But
was this the doctor that also discharged her?
No, this was someone she saw after she saw Dr. Sodoma.
And we don't have those records, correct?
Correct.
And
the thing that's confusing is the information that the patient filled out. She said that she had normal periods, but then in Dr. Sodoma's record, she states that the patient stopped having her periods.
That's not what she recorded.
In the patient stated her periods were regular, but in Dr. Sodoma's progress note, she states that the patient stopped having her periods.
I was typing while she was talking. I don't recall completely offhand. But when I'm typing, they're talking, I'm trying to put all the information I can possibly down on the chart in an accurate fashion. But again, I shut the note after without reviewing the note, which was my error.
Does anybody have any other questions for the doctor? Sorry. Or were you done, Dr. Erbstrasser? I did not.
I just have just a couple more. Maybe it's just an observation.
I think Dr. Chapon does after you, if you'd like to let her talk.
Well, I'll let her go first because I would like to hear from her.
Hi, Dr. Sodoma. Hi, Dr. Chapon. I'm not in your specialty at all. I just wanted to clarify just some clinical things that I just was making sure I understood them correctly. So you said you first saw the patient. She was discharged from another physician, was she previously on hormone therapy or any other treatments for her symptoms? Or
She claimed that she was not.
She was, and what did she say she was discharged for any particular?
She didn't give me a particular reason. She just told me that she was discharged from another physician. I don't know what the physician's specialty was or anything like that.
Gotcha. So she had never sought, so as far as you know, she had never sought treatment for hormone replacement before she saw you. She was just discharged for something completely different. Is that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Don't know. Okay. And what was the, you had mentioned that typically you write for pellet therapy. What was the reason in this case that you chose to write for the subcutaneous injection?
Because the patient asked me to. The patient wanted immediate relief from these symptoms that she was having. And so I acquiesced, which is something I haven't done before or since.
And if I could interject, in the medical record, you documented that the patient couldn't afford the pellets.
That's what the patient told me.
Gotcha. Okay. And, yeah, I guess I did see that late. I was wondering if that was something related to, yeah, the hormones or the pellets. Okay, that makes sense. And then, but you mentioned, so immediate relief, but you mentioned that you weren't going to start, it wasn't your intention to start for her to start the medication until she saw you in follow-up, which you said was typically 2 to 3 months after the initial. It was 1 month. Okay. So typically, you said, is usually a 2 to 3 month follow-up. Okay. So 1 month follow-up, and she had an appointment that she didn't keep, or?
I don't know if she had an appointment that she didn't keep, but it was documented in my chart that she was to return for a follow-up in 1 month.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Know that she was scheduled. Did you tell your staff that you want to see the patient back in a month? I mean,
well, when a patient leaves the exam room, they go to the front desk. The front desk looks up my note, and then they see that there's a 1 month follow up. And then that's what happens is they're supposed to schedule based on what my progress note said.
All right, so one of the issues that I have, and I'm board certified family doc and all of that crap, and I do hormone replacement therapy in men, and the only time I use women is bioidenticals. I use creams. If they desire more, then I refer them out to a hormone specialist. The creams are, as you know, are very reversible, and you can titrate a dose very nicely. And have I put women on testosterone via cream? And the answer from me is I have, but I monitor, right?
Yes.
And the mistake I see here is that all these labs were done, but she had the medicine before her blood tests. And to me, that's just an open disaster. I mean, these people will do whatever they want with the medication, and I don't know why you do that. Do you do a lot of injection testosterone with your patients?
I've never done it before, and I've never done it since.
Okay, so that's a lesson learned, okay?
Yes.
Because I don't do it. And,
I know.
You know, you are a gynecologist. You know more than I know, but I would never do that because, as you know, that once it's there, it's there. And it can also be an abuse potential.
Yeah, she went rogue.
So, board members.
May I, Dr. Herbstrasser?
Yes, Dr. Mayer.
And I'm sorry, Doctor, I should have asked at the beginning. Is that O pronounced like an O or an A, or is it Sodoma?
It's Sodoma.
Sodoma. Oh, gosh. I'm sorry.
I'm using your
name. Sodoma. Okay.
Okay.
I apologize to abuse your name. And remind me, you said in the beginning you did some CME in 2016 on this subject?
Yeah, specializing in pellet therapy.
Pellet therapy, which obviously is your preference. Got it. And how many hours of CME was that?
I believe it was probably about 20.
Wow. Okay, that's more than I'd ever want to know about pellet therapy. Okay.
There's a lot to know.
No, I totally understand. It's the endocrine system. It scared me more than anything else in medical school. That's why I went into emergency medicine. So this is something that you did report, claim for CME with your obstetrics and gynecologist board, is that correct?
No, it was not through the board.
Oh,
it was through a private company.
No problem. I appreciate that. To the board, I see as below the standard of care is no gynecologic examination with a mitigation factor of possibly this would have been done later. So that's not a hard violation, but certainly a documented plan for when the gynecologic examination would be done, or reason it wasn't done in that time frame would have been nice on the chart. There was a lack of laboratories being obtained, mitigated by the patient that the patient was declining at getting those labs. And if I understood you correctly, Dr. Sodoma, I hope I'm saying your name right this time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for your patience. There's below the standard of care for documentation, whether it was done or not, but the documentation of the testosterone side effects, possibly being a controversial use, and no documentation of bringing the medication back for injection, and not documenting the patient's psychiatric background, or as I think Dr. Oda said, other reasons for these symptoms. That last part of the documentation, Dr. Sodoma, is that accurate? Relatively speaking, accurate.
The psychiatric history is in there, but it's inconsistent. In one spot it's there, and in another spot it's not there.
No, I understand. Typing and talking to a patient and getting this done and seeing the next patient, I understand, is difficult, and we all do make errors.
Thank you.
No, of course, Dr. Sodoma. So certainly I think we have some identification below the standard of care. However, the physician seems to have taken action. The physician was trying to help a patient, although possibly being misled by the enthusiasm is probably the wrong word, but of the patient's persistence is a better word. I'm sorry. Citing that, I would like to make the recommendation of a non-disciplinary letter of concern with no additional CME.
I will second that, Dr. Needham.
Thank you.
We have a motion on the floor and a second. Further discussion? Before we move on with the vote, Dr. Sodoma, what have you learned from this?
I learned plenty from this, yes. I don't know. I've never done it before, and I've never done it since. And struggling with typing and talking and counseling, trying to get, check off all the boxes. My error was closing the note prematurely. I should have taken more time. I should have emphasized more with the patient. I should have, it just happened so fast. I mean, if you look at the notes, everything happened within a 2-week period of time. And before, but usually my hormone patients, it's a relationship that I develop over the course of months. This, as you know, hormone replacement therapy isn't something that, you can just go, okay, you get this much, you get this much. It's a relationship. And so I missed out on that relationship with that patient. And it all could have been done completely differently. And I realize that.
Red flags for sure.
Oh, yeah. I understand.
Get the comments.
Dr. Sodoma, thank you for reaffirming why I have never written for injectable testosterone. I appreciate that.
Yes, and I confirm it as well.
All right. So we have a motion on the floor for non-disciplinary concern and no CME, and we have a second. Do we need roll call vote?
No.
Okay, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Oppose? None. All right, very good, Dr. Sodoma. It's great. It's a hard lesson to learn, but fortunately you dodged some bullets there. And Mr. Bullington, I'm sorry you didn't get a chance to say anything.
I figured you all didn't want to hear from the lawyer. You'd rather hear from Dr. Sotomayor.
That is correct.
Well, that's what we'd like to hear from you sometimes, but I don't think you needed to say anything, really. So I think we figured it out for ourselves. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's move on to item 6B. Okay. DO-23-0027A, Dr. Joshua Zeidler, I believe. Is the doctor here?
I am, and that is correct. Thank you.
I said it correctly?
You did.
Okay, thank you. And do we have counsel?
You do. Good morning. This is Kevin Nicholas on behalf of Dr. Zeidler.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's go ahead and is the complainant here? No, he's not, but a family member.
I do not believe we have anyone signed in to speak.
Okay. Let's, Ms. Castro, let's go ahead and swear him in, please.
Can you please raise your right hand? Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Doctor, can you just give us a brief summary of your training and what you're doing now?
Sure. I am a practicing emergency department physician. I did training in a combined residency in both emergency medicine and general pediatrics. And then I've also do subspecialty certification in EMS. I work now for greater than 20 years at our General Regional Medical Center and Mercy Gilbert Medical Center.
Good. Thank you. And do you want to comment, Mr. Nichols, or do you want to wait till later in the summary?
Yeah, I'll wait till later in the summary if necessary.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. Can we have a summary of the case, please?
Yes, sir. this case actually came to us. It is a malpractice case, and that normally malpractice cases are reported to the board by either the National Practitioner Data Bank or the malpractice company. But Dr. Zeidler was renewing his license and disclosed that he had a malpractice settlement. And so he actually was more of a self-report. The malpractice complaint alleged that Dr. Zeidler and the PA that he supervised failed to obtain necessary diagnostic testing at the time of an ED visit for patient RA on November 17, 2017. This was a 77-year-old male. He was seen after a fall from a chair, which resulted in a shoulder injury. It was unclear if the fall was a result of syncope. The patient had a past medical history significant for coronary artery disease, with having had 6 stents placed 5 days earlier. He had an arrhythmia that was controlled with 2 medications, and he was oxygen-dependent COPD. An X-ray of his shoulder was normal. A chest X-ray showed a left upper lobe infiltrate, moderately severe cardiomegaly, and mild pulmonary congestion. The patient was discharged with a shoulder sling and antibiotics. 2 hours later, he suffered a cardiac arrest and did not survive. Dr. Tots, the board-certified emergency medicine physician expert that we had reviewed the case, felt that Dr. Zeidler had fallen below the standard of care. He felt that the history obtained was incomplete in that it did not include what may have caused the fall, such as a syncopal episode, a transient period of weakness, or some issue with his home oxygen supply. He feels they also failed to obtain the patient's baseline functioning or how much oxygen he used at home. Dr. Kotz felt the patient was highly susceptible to an arrhythmia from his underlying coronary artery disease, his atrial and ventricular arrhythmias, his antiarrhythmic therapy, and his QT prolongation issues, and the COPD, which also can cause arrhythmias. He stated that an abnormal EKG may have prompted further diagnostic testing. And as noted, an EKG was not done on this patient. Blood work was also not done. He felt that a CBC may have discovered an anemia. A CMP may have discovered an electrolyte or kidney abnormality. And obviously, a troponin was not performed either, which may have pointed to some ischemia. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Prawl. Dr. Zeidler, would you like to comment?
Yeah. So this gentleman came to the emergency department after falling out of a chair. He was seen by myself and my physician assistant in conjunction. We spoke to the patient. He stated that he fell out of his chair, that he had fallen asleep, causing his fall, that he had done this in the past, and his only complaint at the time was his shoulder pain. He denied any other complaints such as chest pain, breathing difficulties, palpitations. He was appropriately interactive. Both the exam by myself and physician assistant showed the shoulder injury and pain, and we went with that. We did consider syncope and other more serious etiologies of his fall, but felt after discussion with the patient and his exam that those were less likely, and we treated him for his musculoskeletal injury.
Was there any concern, or did you raise an eyebrow when he had 5 days?
Dr. Herbstrasser, can I interrupt for just a moment? I just want to make sure I don't have a problem here. I'm so sorry to interrupt. And if I may, Dr. Zeidler, just to make sure I don't have a problem here, I know your name besides here. Do I know you from the EMS Council, or do you do medical direction with Gamer, or where do I know you from?
Yeah, it's from our EMS relationships. I attend some of the state meetings that you attend, and I do medical direction for some of our local fire agencies.
But you're not directly affiliated with virtual ER, with Gamers, Phoenix Fire, et cetera?
That is correct. I'm not affiliated with them.
I really appreciate it. I just want to make sure I don't have a financial relationship with you. That would make possible conversations awkward. But, yes, I know I've talked to you before. I apologize. I don't know when it is. And I apologize, Dr. Herbstrasser. I just wanted to make sure I did not need to remove myself from the conversation, if you'd please continue.
I think that was very well done, Dr. Matem, and thank you for bringing that to our attention. All right. I have one question, then I'm going to open it up to, you know, the boards. Did having stents placed 5 days before have any concerns for you?
Well, I mean, this patient was chronically ill and had multiple medical problems.
Right.
Knowing that he had had stents placed before actually made me feel a little more comfortable that he had been recently seen by cardiology. He should have been in, you know, peak performance with new stents. He didn't have complaints that would make me think of any sort of cardiac ischemia or dysrhythmia. And so, yes, it was taken into consideration. But once again, this gentleman's simply stated that he fell asleep and had fallen out of his chair.
At all consider calling his cardiologist, or did you consult the cardiologist through the ER?
I did not.
Okay. All right. Further questions?
I have several questions, unless somebody else would like to speak first. So I'll get to the end of the story first, and then we can go through the story, because the end of the story is I don't know. I don't know if there's a problem here. So see if you can help me out, Dr. And is it I know you said already Zeidler or Zeidler? I apologize.
It's Zeidler.
Zeidler. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Yeah, which EMR do you use in your facility, the facility this was at?
Yeah, we use Cerner.
Cerner. So I know with my Epic, when the PA is writing a note, I cannot see it until they push it to me, which sometimes is 2 days later. Can you see your physician assistant note in real time?
No, I cannot. Not until it's completed and then sent to me for approval.
I just want to make sure it's the same as me. I totally understand that. Every now and then I've gotten a note and had it made me syncopize because I saw some things that were not discussed with me, so that certainly can be a problem. And in your emergency room relationship, do you see all patients that your physician assistants see, or just those that are asked for you to see, or a certain level of care?
Yeah, absolutely. No, at our facility, all patients are seen by a physician, including patients that are seen by our physician assistants. And Kane Nickel and I have worked together for, I think it was 10 or 15 years at this time. This was 5 years ago. And so we've worked closely together, and we see patients in conjunction with each other.
Okay. And Mr. Bohol or Dr. Pra, could you just help me out? There were several timestamps on the note or notes. Was there a time frame you could give me for those timestamps?
Yes, hold on.
I appreciate it.
It looks like it was November 17th, 2017, and December 5th, 2017.
And the December signature, what was that about when you re-signed the note, Dr. Ziegler?
Yeah, so, you know, my standard practice is to complete my notes as soon as possible, usually by the end of the shift. It does not mean that I necessarily sign my notes at that time. And so I believe that I completed the, I'm sure I completed the note that day and then just signed the note, I think it was a week and a half later. I did not go back into the medical record or alter that medical record in any way.
All right. So initially your physician assistant saw the patient, discussed the case with you, and then you saw the patient, is that correct? Or something usually like that?
Yeah, so it depends on our workflow. Sometimes I will see the patient directly with the physician assistant. Sometimes we'll discuss the case first, and then I will go evaluate the patient following. Unfortunately, I can't remember the exact method for this patient.
Is your usual practice to do a full HPI and a full physical examination on everybody that physician assistant sees?
It is somewhat abbreviated due to the patient complaint. But I always reiterate the chief complaint and any significant facts regarding that, and then perform an exam on every patient.
And then does the physician assistant usually follow up with you with results, in this case the x-rays, or what happens after that?
Yes, usually once testing is complete, the physician assistant will find me, will go over the results, and then discuss a treatment plan or disposition.
I'm just not certain of the purpose of the physician assistant. It sounds like you do all the heavy lifting here, so that is a heck of a flow there. So if I can paraphrase just a little bit, Dr. Ziegler, a physician assistant has a certain amount of autonomy. If somebody comes in as a shoulder injury, that would be somebody that would, in most emergency room settings, be sent to an APP, a physician assistant or nursing practitioner, if in triage they did not make a strong case for it being cardiac, neurologic, or something else. If they sounded like just a fall with an injury with no head, neck, or back injury. The physician assistant, however, on their note did document the page 2 of the note documented, or page 2 of the chart, page 25 of the entire document, that the patient, there's a little bit of a typo, but unsure if fell asleep or passed out, causing to fall to the ground. One of the issues that I get into sometimes is the patient ends up getting coached intentionally or unintentionally, so they might tell the physician assistant they didn't know. And after they talk to the physician assistant, they become more assured that they just fell out of the chair and they didn't syncopize. But I did not see a documented conversation on the physician assistant or Dr. Ziegler's note about syncope versus near syncope. The x-ray said, pulmonary edema, and there might be a pericardial effusion with that moderate to large heart shadow, but it appeared essentially unchanged from before. And, of course, there's the recent cardiac history and known disease. So there are red flags here. Do I remember, Dr. Ziedler, was this patient on palliative care?
It's documented in the chart, but I don't remember going into any details with him regarding this.
So you don't have any idea why they're on palliative care or when they went into palliative care?
I'm sorry, I do not.
No, that's okay. I wouldn't remember either. This was in 2016 or 17, right? This was 17 years ago. So if I can summarize a little bit, even if this was a syncope, not a fall, syncope actually has a very low morbidity and mortality rate, and the emergency medicine literature, although it still says we should hospitalize somebody with risk factors if there are red flags such as abnormal EKG, et cetera, I know that wasn't done in this case, the overall morbidity and mortality is around 1% in the first 60 days. That's very low mortality for admitting. And mitigating factor number two is if they're in palliative care, then my question would be, even if an abnormality was found, then what would we do with it? In this case, if they decided the patient did have new EKG changes, would they do something if the patient's now on palliative care? So that's where I'll go back to the beginning of my story. I'm not exactly sure where to go with this. The patient was seen by the PA. The PA has a certain amount of autonomy. There's documentation in Dr. Ziedler's note about a fall, although the PA has a fall versus syncope documented in their note, that Dr. Ziedler would not necessarily have seen and would not necessarily have been the conversation. So I'll need a little help from the rest of my board on this one as far as where we need to go. If anybody else could help or ask questions of Dr. Ziedler or myself.
The questions? I have some if somebody is willing to talk. So we don't know what his code status was, right, Dr. Ziedler?
Correct.
So, but he was on palliative care, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And he just 5 days ago had stents placed, so there was, kind of doesn't make sense, but maybe he was on palliative care after they did that because of his ischemic cardiomyopathy. One thing I did find in the nursing assessment at the triage, and this was written by the nurses, that patient states that he fell asleep out of a chair at lunch. He was having lunch. So he's sitting at a table having lunch. I don't think he would just fall asleep unless he's not on his O2. So I'm just saying that's an important part of the triage from the nurse, and maybe we should pay more attention to that.
Absolutely. And so, correct, that quote is in there, that he was having lunch and fell asleep. My impression was that he had finished eating lunch and that he was sitting at the table after lunch when this happened. There was not a plate of food in front of him. This was already, he was just at rest, sitting at the table after lunchtime.
You know, we both of us are being hypothetical, right? I mean, we don't know exactly what happened. That's the concern. So, but to me, that would be like, you know, he's got all these cardiac meds. I'm just thinking, you know, I don't want to be a devil's advocate here, but I just think that we need to be more aware of, you know, what patients actually do say. All right, other questions?
No, Dr. Erbstrasser, if I may, the only thing that I think is, so obviously the outcome is bad, just to get that out of the way. The primary problem that I have is with the charting, which obviously is the responsibility of the doctor, not having an adequate conversation to clarify syncope versus fall. Obviously, doing a full evaluation on everybody that falls is not necessary. But an older patient or those without medical concerns, I personally beat that into the ground and try to document the heck out of it. But I admit I work in a busy emergency room too. Sometimes I really shorten that up. So I think the primary violation in charting is not adequately documenting the differentiation of a fall versus a syncopal episode and then going down whatever branch it is from there. Does anybody else cite any other violations? I'm sorry, anybody else?
No, I mean board members?
That being said, if nobody else has anything further, I would like to make a motion for a non-disciplinary letter of concern for inadequate documentation and potential poor supervision of a physician assistant.
I'll second that.
If I may, before we move forward with that, Dr. Pra or Dr. Pra or Mr. Bohal, are there any reasonable CEs that would be recommended for the doctor? I'd be more concerned about supervision than documentation in this case.
Yeah, we do have some recommended supervision courses. I think they're 6 to 8 hours. If that's
okay, let's discuss that.
Okay. Excuse me, board members. Can I say one thing before you do that?
Yes.
I apologize. I just want to if I could touch on the supervision part of it. I think it's important to recognize that in terms of as you said, Dr. Madem, I think, that normally in these situations, you're going to have a PA who is going to evaluate a patient of this sort. In this particular hospital, the doctors also evaluate the patients. In this particular situation, Dr. Zeiler was doing an addendum to the patient visit by the physician assistant. The physician assistant performed a complete workup on this particular patient. He specifically references in his note syncope. Syncope was on the differential, was on the radar. The discussion that the PA had with the patient was also discussed with Dr. Zeiler, and Dr. Zeiler indicated that he also discussed this issue with the patient. I think it's important to note that the patient at the time had a history of falling asleep all the time in his chair, that the patient had a history of falls, was prone to having falls, that the patient was alert and oriented at the time, that had no confusion. This is a person who, again, this is his quote. This is not a quote from the wife or the family. This is the patient's quote. This is what happened. This is what I did. And as Dr. Zeiler pointed out, he did explore further, which is why he was able to establish that the patient was not sitting at the table with the meal at the time. He had finished his meal. He was sitting, and then he fell asleep. I have to tell you, folks, I don't have the cardiac conditions that this patient had, but I fall asleep all the time in my chair. And I'm sure everyone has done it from time to time. I think it's always a medical decision that has to be made. And as you know, as an ER physician, there are many, many patients you present to the ER that you have to make a decision on. It's a judgment call as to which way you go with the workup on that particular patient. And so I believe that with someone who's been working with Dr. Zeiler for 15 years, it sees patients every single day in the emergency department with these types of patients, because anyone who's 77 years old and plus have a very similar, you know, presentation in many of these instances. But the positive finding was on the shoulder. That was what he presented with. That was what they were able to reproduce. And then you're looking at the whole picture at the same time. So I don't think it's a situation where there's a lack of supervision, nor do I think it's a situation where it's a lack of appreciating what the patient may have. It is documented that they considered that, and that he denied any specific history of syncopal episodes, and that is specifically stated. And when the PA initially talked to the patient, he did not understand what syncope meant. So he explained it, and then afterward, they were able to establish that this was not a syncopal event. No one has established that this was a syncopal event, or that there was a syncopal event that led to this patient's demise. Thank you.
I don't have to respond to that, but I'd like to, if I may, Dr. Herbstrosser.
What are you going to move on with?
No, just my response. With supervision would be that the physician assistant finalize their chart with syncope versus falling out of the chair. They specifically put in their chart, unsure if fell asleep or passed out, causing them to fall to the ground. In supervision, that should have been clarified. The physician assistant should have mentioned they had a discussion and clarified it. And the physician should have clarified that they had that discussion and clarified they were tired, had lunch, and as Mr. Nicholas and myself have done in the past, falling asleep after lunch itself is not terribly unusual. So supervision, having clarified that, would have saved a lot of trouble and potentially a fatality. So I stand by my motion.
So, Dr. Zeidler, were you there when he came back to the ER?
I was still on my shift, but he came back into a different area of the emergency department.
Yeah. I'm so sorry you went through that. That's such a horrifying thing for any of us.
All right. So we have a motion on the floor. We have a second for non-disciplinary action. I don't think, in my opinion, I think it is a record-keeping thing. I don't think Dr. Zeidler needs any CME. I mean, he's a well-established ER doc and very well-trained. So I'm not sure that would be of any benefit.
I'll happily remove my motion for the CME if that would make you happy, Dr. Stresser. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does. I mean, I'm sure he would look at this again in a different way, in a different light, if it was a similar situation. So that's how we learn as physicians. So we have a motion on the floor. We got a second. We don't need a roll call vote, or do we?
You do not.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Oppose? None. Thank you. Thank you for being here, Dr. Zeidler and Mr. Nichols. Your input was valuable. Wish you luck. Keep working. You know, it's so hard being an ER doc. I tell you what, I don't want to be an ER doc. I'm a family doc. Did some moonlighting, but I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And with all the charting,
he's the man.
and all the charting you have to do. And, you know, now they got scribes for everybody, which is not a bad idea, but it's just not real cost effective. So anyway, that's just a little bit of input.
May I clarify, because the motion included the grounds were for inadequate documentation and inappropriate supervision of a PA, but then Mr. Nichols spoke a little bit about that supervision, but the motion is for both inadequate documentation and supervision. Is that correct?
Yes, I stood by my motion.
Okay, thank you. Just clarifying.
Thank you.
That's non-disciplinary. It's nothing that goes on your record, Doug, or anything like that, Dr. Zeidler. So I wish you well. Thank you so much.
If I could, it is disciplinary. It's not reported to the National Practitioners.
Correct.
Right. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
All right. I apologize. It is non-disciplinary. Letter of concern, right?
Non-disciplinary.
Non-disciplinary.
Thank you.
You cut out there, Gene. That scared him.
Yeah. All right, let's take a 10-minute break to go drink some water, do what we want to do. So it's let's say it's 9:50. So maybe get back here at about 10 o'clock or 10:05. 10:05. Okay, welcome back. We're in open session. Let's move on to item 7A, review, consideration, and action on applications for licensure. 7A-DO-23-0079A, Dr. Adam Schulte. Is Dr. Schulte present?
Yes, Dr. Schulte should be signed in to speak.
Yes, sir, I am present. Thank you.
Yourself on TV, please. Video.
I'm sorry, you are on mute.
I am so sorry. I apologize if you don't mind me joining in with my general counsel here.
if
you hear a belch, she just finished a feed, so I just want to make sure you didn't presume it was me. It was this little one.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Dr. Pra, or whoever case this is, can we please have a review?
Yes, sir. Dr. Schulte had a yes answer on the professional conduct portion of his application. Pardon me, regarding discipline or probation during his fellowship, termination from his fellowship, and then denial of privileges. Dr. Schulte graduated from Western University in Pomona, California in 2011. He completed an internship at Arrowhead Regional Medical Center in Colton, California in 2012. He then began a primary care / sports medicine fellowship at the University of North Texas in Fort Worth in 2014, but it was not completed as he was terminated from the program for unprofessional conduct. He is board certified in family medicine. He currently, I believe, holds licenses in Texas and California. Dr. Schulte was given an individual education plan, or IEP, during his primary care sports medicine fellowship. The IEP, signed by him on June 12, 2015, stated that Dr. Schulte had lied to the medical director, Dr. Amy Moss, and an attending Dr. Stockard. The IEP required Dr. Schulte to obtain training in professionalism, write a paper about truth-telling. He was prohibited from moonlighting. He was prohibited from having contact with other medical students, interns, or residents. He was prohibited from participating in extracurricular activities that may take time away from his training, and he was to cease communicating about his concerns to anyone but the director of medical education. Dr. Schulte violated the IEP as he continued to moonlight. Once this was discovered, he was dismissed from the fellowship in 2016. The director of medical education reported Dr. Schulte to the Texas Medical Board, noting he had been dismissed from the primary care sports medicine fellowship for unprofessional conduct, accepting moonlighting hours, which violated his IEP, and had made unprofessional remarks about his program director. The Texas Medical Board ordered 16 hours of CME, 8 in professionalism, and 8 in ethics. Dr. Schulte states he was dismissed from the fellowship as retaliation for speaking up about his program director's affair with another resident. He states the director of medical education then filed a report with the Texas Medical Board alleging he was involved in a relationship with a patient. He states the patient in question is his girlfriend, and she had testified that she was his girlfriend long before she was a patient in the clinic. Dr. Schulte completed the CME, and the Texas Medical Board released him from probation in 2017. Dr. Schulte was denied clinical privileges at Hoag Memorial Hospital in Newport Beach, California, for misrepresenting his credentials in 2018. The hospital stated he had failed to meet the burden to resolve reasonable doubt regarding his fitness to join the medical staff. So there were a couple of things that were a little confusing. I know this was long, but I was hoping Dr. Schulte would be able to clear it up. it looked like to me that he was reported to the Texas Medical Board for unprofessional conduct for violating his IEP. He stated that he was reported to the medical board for conduct with a patient. So he might want to answer to that. And it does not look like he completed that fellowship because it looks like he was terminated right before he was to be completed. Thank you.
All right, Dr. Schulte, let's start there. Let's talk about your fellowship and what happened and why you were dismissed. And we'll ask more questions as we move forward.
Yes, sir, of course. Thank you for the opportunity to join all of you today. I do apologize now. I colloquially refer to it as my fellowship telenovela. It's not the happiest portion of my training. It was. I'll try to answer as accurately as I can, since it has been some time. But as I understand it, initially, my fellowship director, Daniel Clearfield, upon learning from Dr. Amy Moss that I was instructed by Dr. Stockard to report him for unethical conduct for his affair and other conduct surrounding the affair with a married family medicine resident that was under his training, then decided that he was going to, on his own, file a Texas Medical Board complaint, which I don't remember if I provided that document, but it was later found after I was released from the program and supplied by the Texas Medical Board that he did indeed file that initial complaint. Since it was at the end of my training in July of 2015, I was in the process of moving, and the address that the Texas Medical Board had on file was actually my old address, so I didn't receive it. And since I didn't respond to it in the period of time that they needed to, they were able to expand their investigation surrounding the initial complaint, which was the inappropriate conduct with a patient that Dr. Clearfield had fraudulently filed. Since I didn't respond in time, it then expanded into looking further into why I was released from my program, and then they continued with that. So they dropped the initial complaint as far as inappropriate conduct with a patient when my then-girlfriend, Stephanie Strong, provided her affidavit stating that and confirming that we were in a relationship long before she established as a patient in our sports medicine clinic. And then from there it became about moonlighting. That was another part of his complaint when Dr. Moss approached him and said, Dr. Schulte is filing a complaint and he's expressing concerns about your conduct and your ability to lead the fellowship and also with this relationship that you're carrying on with a resident. And so he then came back with, well, he moonlights too much and he partakes in too many extracurricular activities surrounding sports medicine. The latter was actually part of my fellowship curricula. I was required to cover sports medicine programs. It was just, it seemed like at the time he was grasping at straws just for something to, I guess, throw mud in my face and say, he's the inappropriate one. Dr. Moss was also, at the time that I approached her, unbeknownst to me until later, she was actually leaving her position. And I believe she and Dr. Clearfield, as well as Dr. Clearfield's father, who had previously taught when she was there at the university, Dr. Moss and Dr. Clearfield's father had a personal relationship, and it seemed that since Dr. Moss was on her way out, it seemed like an opportune time to, I'm not sure if it's appropriate to say, shield Dr. Clearfield or back up his claims, because when I was put on my IEP and looking at some of those terms, there were some inaccuracies as well. There were some lying to, I think that was the bulk of the IEP or the narrative leading into the IEP, is that I lied to Dr. Stockard and lied about speaking to another doctor. Dr. Moss's recall wasn't accurate. I had mentioned that I didn't know who to talk to, that I started by talking to Dr. Stockard. He said that I should report Dr. Clearfield. He wasn't sure who I should go to, so he recommended the chair of my department, but he wasn't sure, since we were both primary care and sports medicine, whether or not that would be who was Dr. Mason, who was chair of the family medicine department, or Dr. Wagner, who was chair of orthopedics and sports medicine. So she heard that as I spoke to both of them, when in fact I just said I didn't, you know, I spoke to Dr. Mason and I was planning on talking to Dr. Wagner. So that was just one of the hiccups and inaccuracies in her report in the IEP. But she was very concerned about me speaking about Dr. Clearfield to anybody else, which is why she didn't want me talking to anybody else but her. She took Dr. Clearfield at his word without, it seems like, looking at my event coverage history and prohibited me from covering other events, even though that was part of my sports medicine curricula. I believe that covered most of, I think, the issues that were brought up by Dr. Nix. Please let me know if there's anything else I can expound on.
Dr. Pra, is there anything you want to add? Because this is kind of like the Peyton Place kind of thing. It's a little convoluted, and who's this and what really happened. Did he answer what you were looking for, Dr. Pra?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's very confusing, but yes, I think, yes, I understand it, but I only understand it because I've looked at the records several times. I know it would be difficult for anyone who hasn't really delved into this understand exactly what happened, but I think I understand.
Okay. Board members, questions, concerns?
Just a couple of things up front, if I can. Dr. Schulte, what was this about misrepresentation of on your application for hospital privileges at Hogue?
That's a new one to me, sir. I had not been informed of that. I was basically told that I was being denied privileges based on the National Practitioner Data Bank query that they had run, and started diving further and looking at why I was removed from my fellowship. I provided all the same documentation to them as I did to you and the Osteopathic Medical Board of Arizona. So misrepresentation, I had actually retained an attorney to help manage that case for me, since we knew we would be going before a mediator. And unfortunately, that attorney didn't have my documentation provided in time, so I essentially wound up representing myself and appeared before myself, or represent myself in front of the Medical Executive Committee of Hogue Hospital. And then maybe about 30 to 45 minutes into the meeting, I realized I was not going to meet the burden of proof to dissuade any doubt that they had. As Dr. Pratt just mentioned, it's very confusing. It's very... there's multiple layers, and it became more of a, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze for the hospital privileges I was pursuing for Hogue Hospital. It was really just to continue working with a concierge group that I was helping perform, NFL Player Association physicals for players that had retired from the NFL, and they had asked me to obtain hospital privileges.
Let me go back again. I'm sorry, we're getting a little off course there, Dr. Schulte.
Sure.
I'm also a member of a network executive committee and credentials chair for a large hospital system. And we don't put so clearly and concisely such a strong statement as misrepresenting unless there's something going on. So in this 30 to 35 minutes, there was no clear answer as to why you were denied these privileges?
It was simply just related to the Texas Medical Board decision as far as me being released from my program.
And what was the misrepresentation?
That's the part I'm not clear on either, sir. I apologize.
But they did not send you a document formally denying your privileges? This was just by verbal during the meeting that you were denied privileges and you received nothing afterwards?
If I did, sir, I probably had saved that away in a binder or personal record. But it just, after having fought so long to try to clear my name after the whole Texas issues, I just wasn't interested in staying current or fighting any longer. I'd just been exhausted from the whole process. So I agree with you, and I understand where you're coming from. I agree that that kind of verbiage isn't so delicately or lightly put into a permanent record. Unfortunately, I can't provide any more clarity as to why they chose that specific verbiage. I probably do have a written record somewhere as far as the denial of privileges go. I could not tell you where I permanently store that.
Amongst all the other concerns here today, if we don't have a clear answer as to what this misrepresentation was, then it makes it very hard for us to move any further with this application. From my perspective, it would make it difficult to accept an application if there was a question about a recent application that was misrepresented, and it would be very difficult for me to be comfortable with protecting the public if somebody had been dishonest or had other behavior problems. So you're leaving us with a lot of question marks that make it very hard to move forward.
That's all understood.
In the moment, though, Dr. Erbstrasser.
Can we get any kind of information like that, Mr. Bohoff? Can we get records from Hoag Hospital? I mean, I think that would be important, and I agree with Dr. Matum.
We can absolutely request them. I do believe that we have the...
We have the National Practitioner Data Bank report.
But that reports misrepresentation of credentials on page one and failure to prove fitness for medical staff. It didn't give me any other details that are useful. But very clear and concise and strong statements, and it went to NPDB. That's a big deal all by itself. So in the past with this, we've had trouble getting these records from hospitals when it's something that happened in credentials committee, if I'm correct, Dr. Prad, Mr. Bohol, is that correct?
Correct.
So if I remember in the past, what we've had to do is have the physician obtain records and send them to us. Has he not been able to do that?
We can, of course, ask Dr. Schulte, if he would be able to reach out to Hoag Hospital and see if they would forward any of the documentation to us, or if he had any records that he could provide in regards to specifically the denial of clinical privileges.
Of course, I'd be happy to do that.
I think that would be important, give us a little bit more information, as Dr. Matum said. So maybe we should table this and wait till we get that documentation. If the sooner you get it to us, Dr. Schulte, the better off, you know, we can continue to move forward.
Of course, understood.
What about board members? Any other concerns or questions?
I'm sorry. I just want to be sure if there's any other documentation that you believe would be helpful.
Did we get everything from the Texas board? I read several documents from there, but was that their information in entirety?
I believe this is the information that they were willing to provide us. Is the best way I can put that.
Not the answer I wanted, but I understand, Mr. Bohol. It just does not look like a complete document, but the final page of their documentation. Can we get more from the Texas Medical Board than this?
I can, of course, reach out and see what we can find.
I think it'd be worthwhile to see if we can dig up some more information. I mean, when I'm looking at Dr. Schulte, your IEP plan, I mean, they were very concise in what you can do and what you can't do. Would you agree with that, including moonlighting?
I would, sir. If I'm permitted to go ahead and just tack on a little addendum to that, it was a bit concerning and confusing as far as the selection of those activities, why I wasn't allowed to speak with medical students about my program when I was in a training institution, why I wasn't allowed to continue with activities that were part of my curriculum. I won't go any further than that, but what it came down to with the moonlighting is what I thought was the lesser of two evils between being fined for reneging on my remaining moonlighting shifts that I was committed to after receiving the IEP and going back to Dr. Moss and just the concerns I had with the potential for retaliation. As succinctly as I could put it, I just wanted to get out of there. and I didn't want to be fined. I didn't have the $10,000 that physician, the IPA, Inpatient Physician Associates, who was the group I was moonlighting for, said that I would be fined $10,000 and I would be fired from the company if I didn't complete my shifts, explained what happened, didn't trust Dr. Moss and going back to her and explaining what the situation was. And so I just thought, if I just keep my head down and I keep quiet, they'll want me out of here and I'll be gone and we can put this behind us.
That's what they were trying to do, obviously. Keep yourself, you know, keep you quiet, all right, one way or another. But it was a violation, and so, you know.
Correct.
They let you go. And understood. You were close. Were you close to finishing your fellowship?
I was released during my exit interview for my fellowship. I had no other prior notification that I had violated any terms. It all came up literally as I was in my very last day in the room with Dr. Clearfield, Dr. Moss, correct, and I believe Dr. Kennedy, who was the associate sports medicine professor. They asked me to sign a document saying that I accepted the terms, and I refused and walked out, and that's when I secured counsel to start looking into this for me.
Did counsel help you at all?
Well, the counsel that I was provided with by the school had previously represented it. University of North Texas Health Science Center and subsequent counsel who reviewed my case about 2-3 years later. I'm not sure why it was permitted that when it was more than likely that it was another faculty member of the party that the attorney who was assigned to me had previously represented, why they didn't extricate themselves on the grounds of conflict of interest because they had previously
Absolutely.
Represented the university. So that part's still a big mystery. I mean, a lot of it is just naivete on my part. I've never had to be so involved with attorneys and legal action before in my life. And so I just kind of trusted that what was happening was ethical. But as the subsequent counsel who reviewed my case said, it seemed like he was basically assigned to me to protect the bigger whale client, which was UNT Health Science Center, rather than
right.
some fellow who spouted off about a troublesome faculty member.
All right. So we're going to get some more documents. The more you give us, Dr. Schulte, the better it is for you to give us confidence in giving you a license. So I think we should table this and get the information. Do we have to make a time frame on that?
I don't think that's necessary. We'll make sure that we do what we can. I'll likely put this on the August agenda.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
Okay.
All right.
So, Dr. Schulte, one of my staff will be reaching out to you, and we'll see what we can obtain from those two institutions, okay?
Yes, sir. Of course. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Schulte.
Before we sign off, what's your goals here getting a license in Arizona?
Well, preliminarily, it was to perform telehealth services for patients in Arizona for another company that I work with. It's basically just a 1099 provider. It's just a skincare company. They have patients that are there. It's a hydroquinone product, if it's of any value. It's O Skincare or Olivia Keto Skincare, and they have a bunch of patients in Arizona, but they don't have a provider with a license in Arizona to prescribe to patients in Arizona. Alternatively, too, I do have family that live in Arizona, and there are some potential business opportunities with developing an aesthetic spa or med spa, and we're just initiating talks at this point, but that's it at this point.
Where do you live now?
Currently, I'm in Orange County, California.
So are you not practicing sports medicine?
I am. I actually have my own direct primary care family and sports medicine clinic that I run myself. We've been in business for about 3.5 years now. And so I still perform non-operative orthopedics and primary care sports medicine primarily for an athletic community. And I still do and perform a lot of the bread and butter sort of services that a primary care sports medicine doc will do. I'm a team physician for local high school. I help out with the Pop Warner football organizations here in town. I still volunteer at local area sporting events. So for all intents and purposes, I still maintain a lot of the core principles and practices of a primary care sports medicine doctor.
Will you be able to become board certified in sports medicine because technically or did not complete the residency?
That was the big fight pretty much from about 2015 to 2018. I am considered board eligible. I passed my board, my board exam during my fellowship. So prior to graduating, I took that in April and passed. And the only thing that's lingering, it's kind of the Achilles heel. Everything else is completed. It's just that I was released on my last day of fellowship. And for that reason, I would love to have it. I would love to have my CAQSM. I don't know what would need to be done in order for me to finally obtain that.
Okay, so we're going to move forward with this, and we're going to continue the meeting. Thank you for attending, and your baby was very good, by the way.
Really lucked out today. Thank you.
All right. So they'll be in touch with you, Dr. Schulte.
Okay. Thank you all for your time. Thank you all for allowing me to join you, and you all have a great 4th of July weekend.
Thank you. You too.
You as well. All right. That takes care of the cases on the agenda. If you're ready for the bulk,
fire away.
Okay. So we do not have the medical students, so we'll be able to skip over item 8. But moving on to item 9, this is a review of miscellaneous items. What I put on the agenda is potential draft language for statutory changes. Kind of gone through and got some suggestions and put through kind of the chapters that we want to look at amending. I haven't put any formal language or suggested changes, just the sections that we kind of want to look into. So what I would like to ask the board is the Statutes and Rules Committee is formed, but I would like the board to delegate to the committee that they would like to review the statutes to make recommendations in this next legislative session. I would like to have a draft by August so that I could obtain a sponsor in September and get a docket open in October. So that's my timeline for next year's session. So if the board would like to discuss any of the potential changes, if there's any that you would like to see us, any of the chapters that you would like us to address or look at, and then, of course, put this or delegate this to the committee for review.
Okay, so who's on the committee again?
I believe that is Dr. Matem is the chair, Mr. Goodman, and Dr. Walker. Let me confirm that.
Sounds like something I would do.
Yes, that's correct.
So what we want to do is send this to the committee for amendment or suggestions, correct? And then come back?
Correct. So the committee would review it, kind of finalize the language to bring it back to you for approval.
Well, I think I kind of made a motion in a way, right? Okay. Or you did. So do we have a second?
Well, I'd like to make a motion. I think one of us has to make the motion.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Matem.
So move.
Thank you.
And that would be to allow the executive director to pursue legislation in this upcoming session, including contacting a sponsor or securing a sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin.
Okay, that's good.
Do we need a vote? I apologize.
A vote, yeah.
All right. Do we need a? We don't need a roll call, right?
No.
Okay. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes. Okay. Great. You're still on TV, Dr. Bohol. It's still your show.
All right. Moving on to item 10A, this is report from board members. If any of the board members had anything to report or discuss, seeing none, I'll move on to the executive director's report. I do have some exciting news to share. Let me pull up my... share my screen here briefly. Just to give you all a summary of kind of where we're at with our caseload, we've been very, very consistent over the last few years on the number of cases as we go, like, week to week in receiving them and then getting them into the investigative phase. Right now, we have cleared out a bunch of cases thanks to our medical consultant and our investigator. We have not dismissed any cases in the last month. Our priority was on some of the other items I'm going to be talking about soon. And then we have signed a new ISA with the Attorney General's office, and so we will be gearing up and getting ready for our cases that are at formal hearing at OWA in the next coming fiscal year. So we're really very excited about where we're going next year. And then just kind of as the last day of the fiscal year, kind of give you an update on where we're at fiscally. The blue line is the percent of the year elapsed. As of today, we're on the last day of the fiscal year. We're really close to our appropriation. We did not expend everything. We're about 95%, which that means we were really good on trying to find ways to save money, but also make sure that we have the products, services, and items that we need to be able to operate the board efficiently. The red line is the amount of money that we're bringing in for our services. We are continuing to receive more money than we expect each year due to the increased licensees numbers and increased applications. We are not looking to increase any of our fees at this point. It's going to be more about adjusting our budget and making sure that we're expending appropriately, but we will not be raising any of our fees in the near future, which I think is a good thing. Licensing that I want to highlight, over the last 3 or 4 years, you can see that we continue to increase in the number of applications that we receive, as well as the number of post-grad licenses. This is the, pretty much the end of the PGT season. I did want to highlight staff has processed 804 post-grad licenses. And I believe that there are still some that are deficient, but we're working on getting those, getting the final documents received so that we can issue those here shortly. But that covers either transitional permits that came through in the last year, but this, the bulk of this, of course, is our actual PGT season that starts May 1st. As you can see, we've nearly doubled in 3 or 4 years. So we're excited about having all those residents and students and interns and working with them towards them getting a full license. As you can see, our applications, of course, continue to increase. 823 processed so far this year, which is a fantastic work based on licensing staff. A large part of this, and I'm going to be talking about this further down, is contributed to based on the Interstate Medical Licensing Compact and how that continues to grow. As we can see here, this is directly from the Interstate Medical Licensing Compact, and this is the number of applications that we've received each month. We didn't have an updated one for June yet, but we did estimate that we would receive the same number as in April, if not exceed that. But as you can see, we're trending upward each month with the number of applications. In the last year alone, we've had a 50% increase with nearly 390 applications. The compact did just add our 40th state. Hawaii is now a compact state. They will be onboarding and becoming part of the environment here in the next year. And so that Hawaii, any compact members will be able to get a license in Hawaii here shortly. So if you haven't joined the compact, we encourage you to do so. The big project that we tackled this month, we went through a database enhancement with our partner, Authentia Cloud. This was part of the governor and legislative budget and kind of a mandate last year at the end of our fiscal year was that we needed to upgrade our licensure database. So we partnered with Authentia Cloud. We have built a modern new database for our licensees and our applicants. We are now going to be, everything will be submitting online, including address changes, status requests, all the different types of applications will be entirely online and processed through our database vendor. We're very excited about it. We're hearing good feedback from staff on how things work and the modern feel and the modern take of it. So we're very excited about our new platform. And we'll be excited to have a rollout of our renewal process here in the coming months for the renewal at the end of the year. Just some things I wanted to highlight, trying to give you guys more data about the licensee population. We pulled all of the public addresses. So this is all the addresses where they're specifically stating that they're practicing. And this is a heat map showing you all over Arizona where the bulk of those licensees work. As you can expect, large areas around Tucson and Phoenix, but you can actually see a smattering across the state. And so I did want to provide that to you for our Arizona positions. Mm-hmm. And then across the U.S., you can kind of see where the bulk of our licensees are practicing. So just thought that was an interesting data point that you all might want to see. Some hot spots in Southern California, Michigan, and, of course, New York and D.C. So. Then one other project that I wanted to highlight that we've been partnering with the AOMA and the State Board of Pharmacy to ensure that more of the DOs that are prescribing and have DEAs are correctly registered with the Controlled Substance Prescription Monitoring Program. So over the course of the last 2 years, we have been sending notices and reminders to the physicians that are unregistered or do not appear to be correctly registered. In the last 6 months, we've seen a 20% drop in the number of unregistered physicians and a 40% drop since we started the overall project. So I applaud our partners with the Board of Pharmacy and the AOMA to help, you know, really ensure that the CSPMP is utilized properly for the betterment and protection of the public.
Awesome.
And then, thank you. I did want to highlight that we conducted an audit with the National Practitioner Data Bank. They do this periodically to ensure that we're submitting our disciplinary actions timely and that they're accurate. As you can see, we've been compliant since 2014, always trying to make sure that we're reporting our actions timely and within the specified time frame. Then last thing I wanted to share with you, kind of in our spirit of modernization, we kind of discussed last month that there was some things that we wanted to alert the physicians about, different things that were going on. Specifically, it was the DEA requirement for opioid prescribing, different things that were going on that we felt were important. So we have developed our first newsletter that's set to go out next week. I did want to highlight everything for you first. But this will talk about our new website, our new licensing portal, the DEA requirements. I did want to highlight the AOMA has been awarded a grant process to be able to issue grants to physicians that will supervise interns or transitional permittees. So we wanted to highlight that that had occurred. And I did include a survey in there, and I should have brought this up in the legislative discussion, but I wanted to highlight it. I have received comments during the course of the year when we go through renewals that physicians want to consider other options that better match their lives when it comes to renewals. There was a discussion about trying to match with the AOMA and doing it that time of year, and different things like that. So I thought I would include a survey kind of trying to get some information directly from our licensees about what is the best time to renew the license and kind of what that looks like for us, and get that feedback. So I'd like to incorporate those responses to the committee when deciding on the statute changes. But that wraps up everything I had. Did the board have questions?
Newsletter comes, is that on the OMA site?
No, it'll actually come directly from us, and I'll be sending it out next week.
And are we going to be automatically included in that, or do I need to sign up for it?
I will get you included, Mr.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I would like
Very good job.
Thank you very much. I will definitely make sure I get all of our public members and our Attorney General on the list as well.
Thank you. A lot of good work, Justin.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was awesome. It's really good to see. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
So this newsletter is coming through the Arizona Osteopathic Medical Board, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Takes a lot of time to put all that data together.
It does.
I am so lucky for having the team that I have and how hard they work. They work to make me look good, and I work to make you guys look good.
Appreciate that. And Mr. Bohol, maybe not for that beautiful layout you did, and I appreciate you making it look like my APS bill. I can understand it better. But out of that database, can you easily pull the different specialties that we're licensing during any given month or year?
Absolutely.
Do you mind at some point just pushing that data to me? I don't know if we need it in this. I think you've covered the main things we need. But it does make a difference to me, and I'm sure the others, on patient care as far as availability of different specialties, what we're bringing in and what we're not, as far as delays in care, which brings people to the emergency room, and I'm sure delays you all do in primary care too. Because I seem to see some holes, but I'd love to know how much of those holes are from our side, the osteopathic side, not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and one of the things that we do see as a benefit to this new database is a lot more comprehensive reporting to be able to get you answers to those type of questions. So I will be happy to provide that to you.
Thank you. That's amazing. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Justin, I've been perusing the website as you're talking. It looks yeah. Great. The one thing I'm wondering that that MDDO search, I saw that that's no longer on the MD.gov and it's on here, but I'm not able to search the same way that it was. Is that something that's, because we look up past docs and things and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are working on making the enhancement to that, but that is part of the separation of our data from the medical board. So medical board has now their own individual site, and we have our own search site. So that is something that will be coming here shortly.
So eventually you'll be able to kind of search, it has a lot of different search options, but I'm not pulling up as easily as it does on the other.
Yeah.
It's still in progress.
It's still in progress, yes.
Okay.
And any of the feedback that you have, anything specific that you're wanting to see, please let me know. I'll make sure that that's included in that. Yeah. We will have a lot more control over how it looks, how it operates, and what information that we can share. So if there's things that you want to know or want to have available, we can definitely include that.
Thank you.
If that's it, that concludes my report. As I said, I had no dismissed complaints this month. So I think that's it. I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Erbsdosser.
I just want to ask Dr. Maidham if he needs an ice bucket challenge.
I do.
But you're kind of looking like it now.
Yeah, you see, I kept my jacket on the whole time.
Yeah, I see that bead of sweat coming down the side of your head.
I'm waiting for us to motion to move this meeting so I can jump into an ice bath. Have we adjourned yet, or did I pass out?
All right. Well, I just want to thank everybody again for being here today, and the board, and all the FAC, all the other employees just do a great job. You make our job really easy. Sure. And just want to say thank you. All right. So I have a motion for adjournment.
Motion to adjourn.
I have a second. Me.
I'll second.
All right. Mr. Goodman. Yay. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Aye. Okay. Have a great 4th.